From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, in the case of the United States versus John Walker Lind, a.k.a. the American Talib, the defendant was indicted on 10 counts and denied bail. The government drew on three sources to make its case against Lind's release: information gleaned by the FBI and the CIA, emails Lind wrote to his mother, and a CNN interview and news report produced by reporter Robert Pelton, who spoke with Lind in an Afghanistan hospital. The government's original complaint quotes extensively from the CNN broadcast. Pelton has seen the government's complaint and objects to the way his narration was used to make its case. Robert Pelton, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
So then, what's your complaint? We heard the report, we saw the government's complaint, and the facts, as you stated them on CNN, seem to jive perfectly.
Yeah, the only catch here is that when you commit a crime, you would hope that a federal investigative agency would have proof of the actual crime, not use sort of secondhand or casual conversations by people.
Well, here is what the complaint says in reference to your broadcast. It says, in the same broadcast, the correspondent who conducted the interview went on to say that Walker had said that he is a member of Ansar, who are the Arabic-speaking fighters who are funded and supported by bin Laden. He did tell you he was a member of Ansar, right?
Right, but Ansar is actually any group that cannot speak the language of the Taliban. They go into the foreign camps.
So he didn't tell you that this is a group of Arabic-speaking fighters who are funded and supported by bin Laden.
Well, he said he was a member of Ansar, but I explained it more fully because I'm very conversant with the camps and the people that go through them.
The complaint also says that he told you he was trained in the use of a Kalashnikov rifle and was sent to Kashmir to fight.
What he said to me was that he was, I asked him about his military training and he laughed. He did not say that he was trained in the use of the Kalashnikov. And then he did not say he was sent to Kashmir to fight. He said he was with the Kashmiris. And then later on he said that he went to Kashmir. But once again, these are words that I'm writing to narrate a report with.
So the quotes that they are quoting are you paraphrasing and adding and addending his remarks to you.
Right.
Is your concern here that he sounds more knowledgeable by way of your explanations than he was, in fact, when you spoke to him?
Right. I have two concerns here. One is I'm making assumptions because I know exactly what Walker did and where he came from and so on and so forth. But at the same time, let's say I'm a good journalist and I get my facts right. Well, there are plenty of journalists who don't get their facts right. And if it becomes precedent that simple that the FBI simply uses television reports to convict people, God help us.
Do you think that John Walker Lind was drugged when he spoke to you?
The only drug that he had received was an antibiotic. There is a specific point at which the medic says, I'm going to give you morphine now. And I say to Walker, and I also say it so that it's on tape, you're going to have happy juice. Because I also knew that that would be a problem if people listened to this and thought he was drugged. If you know the effects of morphine, he has about 5 or 10 minutes in which, and you can actually watch it on the tape, he gets sort of sleepy and he starts to drift off. During that time period, I don't ask him any incriminating questions. I don't ask him if he's killed people or is he a terrorist or anything like that. So I'm very cognizant of the fact and also the effects of morphine.
It seems very unlikely that the government could accept this testimony, whether directly from Walker and certainly not from hearsay, after drugs like that were administered.
Well, that's actually incorrect. One of the things that you'll find, and one of the reasons why this is so important, is because we're fighting this new war on terrorism, the military can interrogate a prisoner by any means they want and extract any information they need. That information can then be used to prosecute them, not necessarily in a court of law, but it can be used to find out other information.
Well, thank you very much.
Can I say one thing?
Sure.
One of the things I'm concerned about is, when we talk about the media and the press, you know, one of the things that makes America so unique is that we have these very rigid protections of the media and how they gather information. And what I'm seeing here is all the rules are being rewritten in terms of how we handle prisoners, how we fight wars and things like that. And I also see this sort of starting with the media, in that how the media is covering a war is now being used to prosecute a war. And that bothers me deeply.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Robert Pelton is the author of The Hunter, The Hammer, and Heaven, and he interviewed John Walker Lind in Afghanistan.
This week, the president's new trillion-dollar budget cut the funds for a federal initiative launched during the Clinton years called the Technology Opportunities Program, or TOP. The goal was to experiment with small-scale introductions of technology into communities, priming the pump for greater expansion of those opportunities by the private sector. TOP was also the government's prime remedy for the so-called digital divide, the stark gap in access to the Internet between low-income Americans and the well-to-do. The Bush administration says it wants to end TOP because its job is done and its $15 million allocation is needed elsewhere. Joining us now is consultant Larry Irving, the former Assistant Secretary of Commerce under President Clinton. Mr. Irving, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
When the Technology Opportunities Program was conceived, what was the idea?
The idea was to try to find out what applications of technology could improve the lives of the American people. We helped pioneer putting technology in libraries. We helped pioneer the idea of computer technology centers. We were among the first entities to put laptops in police cars. We saved lives in Oklahoma because of a project called OK First that helped give early warning to hurricanes to people who lived in communities where they were so geographically isolated they didn't get information on time. It's really been a phenomenally successful program to demonstrate how information technology can touch and improve the lives of American people. It was intended and has always been a laboratory, and it has helped to spark millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, of investment by philanthropic organizations, state and local governments, and corporations. When we've proven out an idea, others have taken those ideas and improved upon them and made them more ubiquitous.
All right, well, let's talk about success with respect to the digital divide. According to government surveys, as of 1997, only 10% of low-income Americans, defined as earning $25,000 a year per household or less, had access to the Internet. But as of 2001, thanks substantially to the Technology Opportunities Program, something like 25% of low-income households had access. That pump seems pretty well primed.
Not if you're one of the 75% that don't have access, when you're looking at 80% of people with incomes above $75,000 having access. You're talking about a 3-to-1 gap. In a country this wealthy, that's almost criminal. Because we're not talking about access at home. We're talking about access anywhere. These are people who don't use it at the library, say they're not using it at school, they're not using it at work, and they're not using it at home.
We asked your successor in the Bush administration to talk with us on the subject. First agreed to do it, then reneged. So I'll take the administration's points myself. They say that they are spending $1 billion in the education technology budget that they say duplicate the role of the Technology Opportunities Program. Is that not true?
That's just totally not true. The Education Department has no role in trying to develop technology for healthcare. The Education Department has no role in working with law enforcement agents. The Education Department is not working with grassroots community organizations. We have a president who says, let's do things at the grassroots level. Let's empower the people that are really doing things. Let's work with community organizations. The TOP program actually spends money, time, and energy with those community-based organizations to try to get them online and to try to use technologies to reach their constituency. That's not the goal or the focus of the Education Department, and it probably is not their role.
Now, you mentioned empowerment. You can't imagine that the Bush administration is somehow trying to intentionally unempower any segment of the population.
No, I don't believe that, but I think it's a lack of sensitivity of how important these technologies for all of us. We're talking about small investments that are going to have huge dividends. 2 years ago, 3 years ago in this nation, we're talking about the fact that we didn't have enough trained workers to do the technology jobs in this country. We had to import hundreds of thousands of workers and change the immigration laws. We have an opportunity now where we have this moment to make sure that we don't have to import workers, that every child in this country is qualified to do a technology job. Instead, we're going to stop before we get to that point. And I really don't understand that.
We're back to deficit financing of government, thanks substantially to the war on terrorism. Is this just one of those things that America has to sacrifice for the ongoing war?
I don't think there's a more powerful weapon we have than our citizenry. and making sure they're informed is part of a democracy. If you look at a soldier today and look at the technology they have, almost every soldier out in Afghanistan right now is carrying around a Palm Pilot, and he's using that Palm Pilot to do his or her job. Even if we want to have a functioning military in which everybody is capable of serving our country, we've got to train our young boys and girls, men and women.
Larry Irving, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Larry Irving was Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Communications and Information in the Clinton administration, where he also served as Administrator of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration.
Weeks ago, our producer-at-large Mike Pesca was on talking about a Wolf Blitzer interview with John Ashcroft on CNN. He's back with an update of sorts. Mike, what have you got?
Well, Brooke, to harken back to that interview, 2 weeks ago on CNN, Wolf Blitzer asked Ashcroft about Enron, and Ashcroft said, "I won't talk about it. I've recused myself."
Right, and Wolf punted on any potential follow-up by changing the subject to the upcoming Rams-Eagles game.
Okay, with that as prologue, I found Wolf's Q&A with another member of the administration, Condoleezza Rice, very interesting. Wolf read this provocative quote from Ariel Sharon.
"There was an agreement in Lebanon not to kill Yasser Arafat. Actually, I am sorry that we did not kill him. If Arafat takes all the steps we are demanding that he take, as far as I am concerned, he will again be a partner to negotiation."
To which Rice responded,
"I'm not going to comment on everything the Israeli prime minister says."
But on the second part,
she talked about the second part, the part that didn't have anything to do with wanting to kill Arafat. The part that was a totally commonplace utterance as opposed to the shocking first part.
Right. And just like with Ashcroft, Wolf didn't press her on it. In fact, here's what happened next.
"Aspirations of the Palestinian people."
"Dr. Rice, we have to leave it right there. But today being the Super Bowl here in the United States, a lot of speculation that one day when you leave government, you'd like to be the commissioner of the NFL.
That's true. That's not speculation. That's fact.
So you want to tell us who's going to win the Super Bowl?"
"Well, shouldn't I be reserved?"
It's the end around revisited.
I just wanted to note that if during the Dolphin-Ravens game, President Bush was answering policy questions as opposed to snacking, he would have saved himself from a very embarrassing pretzel-related mishap.
Very sobering, Mike. Thank you. Mike Pesca is OTM's producer-at-large and current co-host of Wolf Blitzer's Political Pigskin.
Coming up, the man who put big sounds in small boxes and the latest take on the Hollywood shuffle.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Stereo owners and lovers of radio everywhere should observe a moment of silence this week. On Thursday, we saw the passing of an audio pioneer. OTM's Jad Abumrad has this tribute.
To really understand what Henry Close did for home entertainment, you have to go back to 1950, a time when getting really good bass from your speakers, or even adequate bass from your speakers, would require boxes the size of refrigerators.
One was bad enough. You know, to get the wife to go along with one gigantic thing was hard enough. But then when stereo came in, it was like two of these? I don't think so.
Michael Fremmer is senior contributing editor to Stereophile magazine. Luckily for him, Henry Close had just come up with a nifty trick that could get deep, rich bass tones out of a speaker that could fit on a bookshelf. Hi-fi wasn't an industry yet, just a group of tinkerers like Avery Fisher, Saul Marantz, and Henry Close. Whenever any of them had an invention, they'd march down to Cortlandt Street in Manhattan, known as Radio Row, and hawk it directly to audio shop owners.
And Henry went in there and said, let me play this woofer for you. And they turned it on, and there was this incredible bass coming out of this little box. And they didn't believe him. They thought he was, a snake oil salesman, because they heard it, but they didn't think it was possible, so they didn't buy it. They passed on it.
But before long, Close's AR-1 speakers would sell millions and usher in a new era of portable audio gear. According to Fred Kaplan, staff writer for The Absolute Sound, this would be the beginning of a series of firsts.
You open up the suitcase, and there was a little turntable with two little powered speakers.
The portable stereo attaché case was called the KLH Model 11. All the rage in the 70s, it was the precursor to the boombox. Next, Close took the standard cassette deck and gave it Dolby Hiss Reduction, making cassettes the dominant format for a time.
What he specialized in was taking things that were around, combining them into a package and putting them into something that looked good, that was designed well, and that was affordable.
Born in Altoona, Pennsylvania, Close always kept the pockets of his tweed coat filled with transistors. Friend and colleague Jim Willens describes them as a Disney caricature of a mad scientist.
In fact, I recall many times that Henry would have broken his glasses and have taped them together, or maybe there would be a piece missing off of his glasses, and it just wasn't important enough to him to have to go handle that because he was too busy working on a new electron gun or a new type of phosphor or a new way of building tubes.
Willens worked with Close in the late 70s on an ambitious experiment with home theater. He remembers Close being nearly broke without equipment and using a lobster pot and a couple of Sears vacuum cleaners to develop a new style of TV tube. That tube would basically create the entire home theater industry, but Close's company would flop. Still, Fremmer says Close's handiwork can be seen every time you look at a Walkman or a small speaker delivering a lot of sound. He just worries that without Close around, the stuff will get smaller. It just won't sound any better.
No one wants big anymore. Kids want these little plastic pieces of junk to put next to their computers. I feel really sorry. I feel sorry for young people today. I mean, you know, MP3s, the sound is horrible out of an MP3. It's just not good sound. But it's free. Free, and it stinks. Okay, that's just what a great concept that is.
Henry Close leaves behind two daughters, seven grandchildren, legions of adoring audiophiles, and a few hundred million stereo owners who probably don't even know his name. For On the Media, I'm Jad Abumrad.
On Wednesday, January 16th, police raided an adult video store in Johnston, Rhode Island, and issued summonses to seven people on morals charges. Their names and addresses were all printed in Friday editions of the Providence Journal, the region's dominant daily newspaper. 2 days later, one of those arrested, Stuart Denton, the 55-year-old chairman of the Plainfield, Connecticut Planning and Zoning Commission, hanged himself in his backyard, fomenting criticism of the paper for shaming the suspects and making them the only victims of an otherwise victimless crime. Joining us now is Joel Rawson, executive editor of the Providence Journal. Mr. Rawson, welcome to OTM.
Hi, how are you, Bob?
Before we get to the particulars of this case, what is the Providence Journal's policy regarding naming those accused of crimes?
We have a lot of crime news in the Providence Journal. Most of it is gathered every day from the police stations around the state. We routinely name the names of people who have been arrested and charged and the people who were the victims of the crimes.
All crimes, large and small, serious and petty?
Most crimes, large and small. There will be some towns we don't get to every day.
Now, obviously, sexual misdemeanors carry with them a stigma of humiliation and shame, maybe out of proportion to the crimes themselves. Does your policy take that into consideration, or is it like, if you can't take the heat, stay out of the porn shop?
Our policy doesn't take it into consideration. We don't differentiate between crimes on whether or not we'd use the accused names.
Why?
Well, the basic reason is that if you begin to say this crime is a crime that we don't report and that crime is one that you do, you're beginning to reflect your own personal judgment on crimes. There was a white-collar worker at the Providence Journal who was arrested in Fall River for soliciting a prostitute. And his name, address, and association with the Journal, the fact that he was an employee, was included in the story. If we had not run that story and not had a policy of routinely running this thing, I think we would have been open to the criticism that we covered up for people who we knew or were our colleagues. So the blanket policy just kind of makes it an even playing field and makes it, if unpleasant, fair for everyone.
Well, I think these are complicated matters, and you're faced with balancing the community's right to know against a sort of cruel and unusual publicity. Do you ever discuss that conflict internally?
No, I think a long time ago, one of the things I resolved is that publicity itself is not the punishment. There's a popular conception that if you are arrested for drunk driving, you're further punished by being in the paper. I don't think a professional news person can look at it that way. I think you have to look at it that your basic duty is to print the news and the public record.
The naming and shaming of alleged violators, whether it's in your intention or not, certainly serves the local government's purposes of creating a disincentive to patronize a porn-related business. Are you, in that sense, letting your paper be used as a weapon by police and by politicians?
Well, I think the first answer is that in some small way, yes. In making high-profile cases out of such things as arresting people who solicit prostitutes, which goes on fairly frequently in the city of Providence, we've also seen it done with drunk driving. An attorney general who had a crusade against drunk driving made sure that lists of all drunk driving arrests were provided to us, and we cooperated in publishing them, knowing that that was part of what he was doing, was trying to shame people. So, yes, that does happen. It does happen frequently. In this case, it happened with a pornographic movie theater.
So when Mr. Denton hanged himself, the journal obviously took a lot of criticism. Some people were blaming the messenger. But internally, did this incident cause you to reevaluate your policy?
No. You know, nobody can ignore a death. You're taken aback. I mean, you ask, you know, what's going on and what do we do here? But I think the coverage policy is sound. I think the first ethical position of any journalist, any newspaper, is to publish the news.
What follows is a question. It is not a statement or an accusation coyly camouflaged as a question. It's a question.
Okay.
When people said to you that you have blood on your hands for your callous treatment with respect to Mr. Denton, what was your reaction?
Well, tell you the truth, Bob, I was a soldier in Vietnam. I was a reconnaissance pilot. And people at that time were pretty angry with soldiers. The way you deal with that is you look at it and say, well, you know, I did my best. I did what I could to conduct myself honorably. The actual fact of the matter is that people probably died because of what I did, and some people who had very little to do with the war probably died because of what I did. And I looked at this, and I thought, is there blood on my hands? And I thought, well, no, I did my job. It is a job worth doing, informing the public. I did not deviate from any common practice that we have and has stood the test of time. And then, ultimately, what Mr. Denton did was his choice.
All right. Well, thank you very much. This is where you say you're very welcome.
You're welcome.
Joel Rawson is executive editor of the Providence Journal. February is Black History Month, and as usual, a relatively good time for black actors. But a coalition of advocacy groups has long clamored for more screen time for ethnic actors all year round. The networks have responded in part by hosting showcases where minorities have the chance to perform in front of talent scouts and agents. Reporter Trang Ho has the story.
I don't know. I was looking out the window of the party and I drank some wine.
Kennedy Cabasaris rehearses a love scene from a short play called The Red Coat in a downtown L.A. studio.
John.
I felt that wine and that moon and your face all pushing in my heart.
On this day, Cabasaris was preparing for a showcase sponsored by Fox. He went on to perform the piece in front of scores of TV executives and casting agents.
It's beautiful. I didn't think a street lamp could be so beautiful. Mary, I love you.
Oh,
I shouldn't have said it.
Until he lands a regular role, Cabasaris, who's Filipino-American, supports himself working two jobs at a public relations firm and a theater. The network showcase will give him exposure to key industry players that he would not have access to otherwise. These showcases were an effort to add more color to next fall's lineup. ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC invited minority performers to demonstrate their talents, though they weren't auditioning for any particular roles. Carmen Smith is the vice president of talent development at ABC.
I think that what we've done is put in place a mechanism that will help us as a company
in opening up the doors to actors and directors and writers of all backgrounds.
2 years ago, African American, Asian American, Latino, and Native American civil rights groups banded together to grade the four major networks on their diversity records. The report cards they turned in were peppered with C's and D's. ABC's Carmen Smith shrugged off the criticism.
The showcase, the planning for that, really had taken place prior to any of the report cards that had come out. I had already started working on this prior to that. This is already in the works.
Alex Nogales leads the National Hispanic Media Coalition. He says the showcases are a work in progress, and the networks still have plenty of room to improve.
The things that I have heard is that not enough actors were notified, that the selection of the actors was not adequate.
Nogales' skepticism is shared by others from the coalition. Guy Aoki, president of Media Action Network for Asian Americans, questions whether the showcases are a genuine effort to find hidden talent or just a public relations ploy.
My contention has been that nothing's going to change until the writers and the producers and the executives really go through some diversity training where they have to actually confront the racist attitudes they have toward minorities.
Part of the problem, he says, is that Hollywood tends to see race only in terms of black and white.
Mostly they only want white and maybe some black actors anyway. The problem is that they've got blinders on and they don't really conceive that Asian American actors can play, quote, white roles. So the only thing they allow us to play are the stereotype roles, where we're the Chinese waiter in a restaurant or a kung fu artist. It's just really, really stupid thing.
A report from the Screen Actors Guild shows the number of African Americans on TV right now is disproportionate to the actual number in the country. According to SAG figures, while African Americans make up 13% of the population, they account for 16% of the characters on prime time. By contrast, Asians and Latinos are underrepresented across the board. Actor Kennedy Cabasares has a theory as to why networks might be reluctant to create roles for Asian Americans like him.
They have a demographic to think of and sponsors to think of, and they have to think, well, would the audience be open to seeing, you know, Buffy dating an Asian guy, you know, that kind of thing.
Already there are reports of success stories as a result of the showcases. Three-quarters of the Latino actors who read for ABC were called in to read for the George Lopez show. Many of them who didn't have agents before now do. As for the Asian actors, one landed a guest star role on ABC's The Practice, and another was booked for a sitcom, The Random Years, on UPN. Kennedy Cabasares has also had a taste of success. As a result of performing in the showcase, he's landed a part in a commercial and an appearance on Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Because both gigs were scheduled to shoot on the same day, Cabasares was forced to choose. He opted for the commercial. Though disappointed, he says it was one problem he didn't mind having. For On the Media, this is Trang Ho in Los Angeles.
So we are joined now by the actor Luis Guzman, who I loved in Traffic and The Limey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, the piece we've just heard cited some numbers from the Screen Actors Guild. SAG says that African Americans are now pretty well represented on television, while Asians and Latinos are still pretty much left out in the cold. You are of Puerto Rican descent.
Yes.
And you've had a pretty extensive run on television. I have some of your resume here on the list of your TV credits. You've played criminals, thugs, drug dealers.
Yeah.
Do you think that you've been typecast?
I think that maybe early on in my career, I certainly was typecast. Again, we're going back to like 1985, you know, when I first started out in this business.
Ratings watchers seem to suggest that the viewing audience, or the largely white viewing audience, just doesn't seem to have much of an appetite for minority characters, with some notable exceptions like, say, Bill Cosby, that they don't identify with them.
You talk about viewers. I mean, Latinos watch TV in droves. I mean, come on, this country is made up now, like, what, 30% Latino? And the industry is not going to tap into that. It's not about taking a risk. It's about saying, hey, you know what? You got a Latino audience there, and you're going to have to give them some of their own flavor. And not only just for Latinos, but for white America and black America and Asian America and you name it. Because I think part of the problem is in TV land, if you have a whole bunch of white writers writing a Latin sitcom, and they don't bother to employ a few Latino writers involved in that, they're never going to get it right. It's always going to be about a Cuban family in Miami. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's not good representation of the Latin population or the Latin community in this country.
How many times have you been presented with the Cuban family in Miami scenario?
Oh, I say like 5 or 6 times, you know? And the thing is, when you tell them, well, how about doing something about a Latin family in New York? They don't get it, because a Latin family in New York, you have a Puerto Rican mother, a Dominican father, a Cuban boyfriend. You know, it could be just a Latin family. And just take it from there, you know? They have an accent, you know? But dad is a doctor, you know, mom is a principal of a school, as opposed to, well, mom is a seamstress, and my dad changes tires at the tire shop.
As I mentioned, African-American men, at least, seem to be better represented on television, but the roles that are available seem to conform to type. You have the comedian, family man, prankster. Is there a stereotypical role for Latinos on television?
How TV portrays Latinos right now, it's not happening at all, you know? It might be a guest spot here, a guest spot there, but as far as showing, you know, a regular Latino in regular daily life, they still have yet to get that.
Now, you've been an actor for a while. Do you think that things have loosened up a bit? Do you think attitudes have changed since you've been in the profession?
I absolutely believe attitudes have changed. You know, I mean, we need to also understand, it's like, it's also about the opportunities that you could create for yourself, and not just waiting for somebody to create an opportunity for you. You know, now more than ever, you could definitely, you know, you could get into the game.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, I want to thank you guys for your time, you know.
Actor Luis Guzman has 8 movies coming out this year.
Coming up, perspectives from Black and White and Left and Right.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Marco Williams, who is Black, and Whitney Dow, who is white, were old friends, both of whom grew up to be filmmakers. It was a horrific, racially motivated murder that brought the two men together in a working relationship. In 1998, James Byrd Jr., a Black man, was torn to pieces as he was dragged from the back of a truck in Jasper, Texas. As the murder trials got underway, Dow and Whitney decided they would make a movie in Jasper to place the crime in some sort of context. So they segregated their production. The Black director and photographer would film the Black citizens, the whites would film the whites, and the result is a film with an extraordinary degree of candor called Two Towns of Jasper. They join us now. Marco Williams, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Whitney Dow, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Did you two find yourself sometimes not on common ground in editing the film?
It was an exceedingly difficult process because we didn't review each other's footage for the entire year that we shot. So I never saw what he shot. He never saw what I shot. We would talk periodically, and if I happened to be going by his hotel room, I might see a couple of frames that he shot, but we didn't view the stuff.
That's amazing. Why did you make that choice?
Because we really wanted to give each other the opportunity to really immerse themselves in their own community and really find the story there without any advocacy from the other side, to say, really, to be able to come back and say, this is what I found. Once we completed shooting, we then worked independently of each other for 6 months with separate editors. By happenstance, I had a black editor, Mark had a white editor, and we cut scenes, sequences, ideas that showed what we had investigated, and then we presented that material to each other. So it was really 18 months before we even saw what each other was up to. Then we brought in a third editor and took those set of scenes, and together we started to build a narrative out of those scenes.
And what do you think you got that you wouldn't have gotten if the black director and cinematographer went to talk to white members of the community and the races were reversed on the other side? Give me an example.
There's a scene where a group of whites are sitting around the table and they're talking about why they use the word nigger.
You know, I'm amazed at how easily offended people have become. Well, I don't mind telling you, I was raised with the word nigger, but it had no negative connotation in my life.
They're all sort of agreeing with each other, sitting around the table. Yeah, I never thought it was wrong. I never thought it was wrong. So it's that type of thing. I think that with Marco in that situation, there's no way that they would have been as frank in their discussion of that word as they would with me there.
I think that the evidence of this approach being effective within the black community is somewhat more subtle. One scene is of Walter Diggles. He is the most prominent bureaucrat in the town. He's the head of an organization, a county organization, and he's on a driving range.
Yeah, man, that's a good hit ball. There's still a problem in this country with the perception of blacks that you and I are not going to be able to just erase, because we can't control the heart of somebody else. We can't change a white man's heart.
On first blush, you'd say he's talking, if he was talking across race, he's talking about we as black people. But in fact, he's really saying we, myself, Jonathan, the cameraman, both black men there. You know what, Marco, we can't tell what's in a white person's heart.
Is there a scene where both of you agree, God, we just nailed that. We could not have gotten it any other way?
The confrontation between Ethel Parks and Lewis Berry on the courthouse lawn during the third trial, where this is the only time in the course of the entire film where black and white face off with each other. The white crew is on one side filming their white character, and the black crew is on the other side filming their black character. That allows us to intercut it seamlessly like a fiction film.
The tattoos.
That was a symbol that he didn't like black people, right. Those tattoos.
The tattoos were bad. We don't agree with them.
I have a lot of pity for him. But do you realize if he don't get the death penalty, he goes to prison.
He's going
to
die.
He's going to die anyway, or he's going to be tortured. Do you realize this?
I do realize this.
I'm still not clear on how your two intentions collided.
Let me give you an example. You're cutting a sequence on any subject. Is the first scene in that sequence with a black person? Is the last one with a white person? Who sets the agenda for the sequence? Who seems to be the driving force? Editing is a very subjective process.
How did your relationship change? Did it bring you closer or further apart?
How deeply we are divided by our cultures was not apparent to me before we started the project. And I think that I recognize now that the gulf that divides us, because simply growing up as a white American, him growing up as a black American, is much greater than I thought and not necessarily bridgeable in my mind.
Marco?
I don't think I entered into this with this naivete or of optimism that, we shall overcome, but I did feel profoundly disturbed by how deep the chasm of our racial experiences are, and that friendship alone doesn't bridge it. There's much more needed to really get to an understanding, which I think is the positive of what Whitney and I went through. We essentially had to roll up our sleeves and confront the racial divide on a daily basis.
What one is left with after seeing the film is the sense that things have changed, but they can never really be resolved.
Yes, things have changed, but they aren't resolved. But there's the potential for individual change within all of us, and that to look for wholesale sea change is perhaps not where we should be looking.
Marco?
In my view, It's not enough for us just to see one individual white person change or another. It's that we want to see a greater social change. I believe that for white people, it's much harder to understand the nature of the institutional racisms. And this is what I like about our film, and I think this is where we were quite successful, is that our respective viewpoints as filmmakers, our respective viewpoints as a black and white man, and the multifaceted viewpoints of a town are represented.
Thank you very much, Marco Williams.
Thank you very much.
And Whitney Dow, thanks to you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Whitney Dow and Marco Williams directed Two Towns of Jasper.
Increasingly, since September 11th, America has counted on Turkey as an essential ally. As former U.S. Ambassador to Turkey Mark Paris remarked recently, the Bush administration understands that whatever you're going to do in Iraq, you're going to need Turkey. And America has given that nation wide berth in conducting its own affairs. Also, since September 11th, America has heard more than usual from one of its most implacable critics, the linguist and political essayist Noam Chomsky. His recent book, 9/11, condemns the U.S. as a terrorist state, fully complicit in the human rights violations committed by its allies. This week, Chomsky travels to Turkey, where his publisher stands charged as a terrorist for printing a collection of Chomsky's essays. Turkey's anti-terror laws ban books that, quote, propagandize against the indivisible unity of Turkey. Mr. Chomsky joins us on the phone. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Give me a little background here. The Turkish government has assuaged the European Union by passing free press laws, but I gather those laws are just entirely trumped by the gimmick of invoking the anti-terrorism statute.
Well, they're one of the many mechanisms. For example, the free press laws themselves do not permit free use of the Kurdish language in education and public broadcasting. Even Kurdish songs.
So in that environment, what is to be gained by you testifying?
I'm not testifying. I'm appearing at the trial as part of a protest organized by Turkish journalists, other writers, academic figures, and others against the draconian laws and their implementation. And since it happens to be a few words of mine that are the occasion for the trial, they requested that I attend, and I will.
Well, let's examine the actual text to see what's so dangerous to the Turkish state in what you've written. It said, the Kurds have been miserably oppressed throughout the whole history of the modern Turkish state. In 1984, the Turkish government launched a major war in the southeast against the Kurdish population. The end result was pretty awesome. Tens of thousands of people killed, 2 to 3 million refugees, massive ethnic cleansing with some 3,500 villages destroyed. That's it, right?
That sounds accurate. The sentences that you're reading are actually from a talk which was transcribed and then published in Turkey, wasn't published here. And the focus of the talk is on U.S. support for Turkish atrocities. All of that was eliminated. The few sentences that you quoted from the talk about the Turkey and the Kurds are virtually drawn from standard human rights reports.
And in the universe of seditious materials, pretty benign. Did you say that we should not forget that the United States itself is a leading terrorist state?
Of course we should not forget that. The fact that the U.S. is a leading terrorist state, it's not controversial. I mean, Osama bin Laden is a murderous terrorist, but he doesn't have anything like the capacities of any state. And that's true of most states.
In the context of your general views towards the United States behavior and your explicit statements that the United States is a terrorist state, does it strike you that the material that was quoted in the Turkey case is relatively innocuous by Noam Chomsky, human flamethrower standards?
First of all, I'm not a human flamethrower. What I do here is pretty much what I did in the talk that the prosecutor selected sentences from. I use documentation that is public and available. It's innocuous by the standards of the Human Rights Watch reports and the scholarly literature and others from which I drew those comments. And in fact, recall that they excluded what I actually said, namely criticism of actions for which I'm responsible as an American citizen. That's what I focused on.
Okay. Well, listen, Noam Chomsky, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah.
Noam Chomsky is a professor at MIT. He's joined us from his home in Lexington, Massachusetts.
When George W. Bush was spotted toting around a copy of the New York Times' number one nonfiction book, Bias, it was the best example of presidential product placement since Clinton sipped Canada Dry during his deposition. Bias is subtitled, A CBS Insider Exposes How the Media Distort the News. And Bernard Goldberg is that insider. Welcome to OTM.
My pleasure.
Your campaign against bias in the newsroom went public in 1996 when CBS ran a report called Reality Check, where reporter Eric Engberg criticized Steve Forbes' flat tax. Actually, he mocked it. And that seems to have been the straw that broke your back. You opined against it in the Wall Street Journal. It eventually led you out the door at CBS.
Right.
What about that got your goat?
I had been complaining about liberal bias at CBS News for years, but they didn't pay any attention. And on this particular story, it was a straw that broke the camel's back, and I sat down and wrote the op-ed.
You talk about how, to illustrate social problems like homelessness or AIDS, the networks want to showcase attractive white people with the afflictions as opposed to how it really looked in the population.
Now you're going to tell me that's a conservative bias.
No. What I'm asking is this a question of liberal bias, or is this merely a reflection of TV's obsession with its largely white affluent self?
Yes, that's part of it. And they do it for ratings, because you're much better off showing people who look like your neighbors as homeless than people who are baying at the moon who are homeless. So that's part of it. But if we get the homeless story wrong, and we did, I mean, we exaggerated the numbers, we misled people on who the homeless were, but there's a sympathy for the homeless lobby that you don't get for the NRA. Now, you may think...
I may think it's because the NRA population is in less in need of my sympathy than the homeless population.
That's a seductive point, but that's precisely the problem. When the media picks certain groups to feel sympathy for, and in the process doesn't give the rest of the America the correct picture of the situation in order to drum up support for a good cause, that's not what we should be doing. That's something that social workers should be doing.
Can we move on to IDs?
Yep.
You note that Rush Limbaugh will always be referred to as a conservative talk show host, but Rosie O'Donnell is just a talk show host. Is that an indication of bias, or is it just that Rosie got famous being a stand-up comic and that Rush's only job is to talk politics?
Well, the bigger point there is that we have 20/20 vision when it comes to identifying conservatives. We're deaf, dumb, and blind when it comes to identifying liberals. If you've got two groups and one group is made up of conservative women, which we identify as such, but the other group is made up of members of NOW and we don't identify them, I think that's a problem.
But we don't identify the NRA as conservative because we don't need to. We know what it is. But who knows who the Eagle Forum is?
No, I understand what you're saying. And I think certain groups need more identification than others. What I find so fascinating is that this book, which has touched so many people in America, really gets some people in the media way angrier than it should. And I wonder what it is about this subject that gets people as angry as it does.
Well, Mr. Goldberg, let me give you an analogy that might explain it. You're a sports journalist. You can say anything about the NFL you like, except that the games are fixed.
And I'm saying the game is fixed.
Yeah.
If they said the game is fixed in the NFL, everybody, every reasonable person would be yelling bloody murder if it were true.
Even if it were false, they'd be yelling bloody murder.
Yes, but lots of people would, is my point. Many, many people out there, millions and millions of Americans, agree with what I'm saying. They agreed with it before I said it.
I think it's been said for years that the population at large is to the right of the population of the major networks, I also think that the center is a moving target. The sorts of issues that Richard Nixon held onto in the 70s would be regarded as wildly liberal today.
Oh, I think he was our last liberal president.
And yet he was considered very right-wing at that time. And I think it's a lot to ask that the people in the news media constantly shift to reflect the political leanings of the public at large. I think that both of those tend to shift with relation to each other across the decades.
I don't want the media to pander to America. I don't want them to present a newscast that's to the right of center, even if most Americans are to the right of center. I think they should merely present us with more points of view along the political spectrum, and we'll be fine. That's all I'm asking for.
Bernard Goldberg, it was a pleasure talking to you.
It was a pleasure, and it was very interesting.
Bernard Goldberg is the author of Bias, A CBS Insider Exposes How the Media Distort the News.
On the matter of assigning labels, Esquire's Charlie Pierce thought that if the media insists on assigning political labels to politicians, then it's only fair that news people submit to some truth in labeling themselves.
That's This Week, featuring George Will,
Reagan debate pit crew chief and baseball nuisance,
and George Stephanopoulos,
phonafe careerist hack.
Now, Sam Donaldson.
Inhaler of federal sheep subsidies.
This is the December 23rd edition of Fox News Sunday. Fred Barnes,
right-wing meat puppet, will opine for food.
Mara Liasson,
famous NPR Republican double agent.
And Mort Kondracki,
fake centrist pamphleteer.
I'm Chris Matthews,
Carter speechwriter and part-time air raid siren.
Is this my hardball?
Charlie Pierce writes for Esquire.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Jim Colgan. Our webmaster is the redoubtable Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.